Before we begin this week's episode, I want to share a book I recently finished by Kensington Publishing. American Fly Girl by Susan Tate Ankeny chronicles the amazing true story of Hazel Ying Lee, an unrecognized pioneer and unsung World War II hero who fought for a country that discriminated against her gender, race, and ambition. Inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Hazel was the first Chinese-American woman in U.S. history to earn a pilot's license and fly for the military as a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Now, I'd heard of the WASPs, but really knew nothing about them or their incredible stories until reading this book. American Fly Girl, the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, who followed her dreams against all the odds and became an American hero, is written by Susan Tate Ankeny and goes on sale April 23rd, 2024, wherever fine books are sold. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Hey everyone, Vincent Aiello here from the Fighter Pilot Podcast. As we told you on the last episode, we are returning to our 3-episode-per-month format. And so we're picking back up here on September 12th with a bonus replay of our Facebook Live question and answer segment with Jerry Turkey Tucker from last July. And we're going to replay it here. Forgive us for the audio. It's a download of the Facebook audio itself. We didn't record it separately, so we're doing our best with that. But it was a fun time with him, and you can listen to all the questions and answers that we had and some dialogue with Turkey, our F8 guest previously. And we will pick it back up with our next feature episode on September 22nd. So enjoy this bonus, and we'll see you next time. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast Facebook Live question and answer segment. My name is Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello.
I'm Brian Sinclair, call sign Sunshine.
And who is with us today, Sunshine?
My name is Jerry Tucker. My call sign was Turkey.
All right. Well, if that name sounds familiar to you, that is because he was guest of our episode 50 on the F-8 Crusader, one of many aircraft that he flew. And before we get started, I just want to, Jerry, provide some feedback for you on why you're here. Your hit episode was amazing. Everyone loved it. And so some of the feedback that we have, I'll read it to you. One person said, I could listen to Turkey's stories all day. Such a humble man and someone I consider a role model. This guy is gold. Wow, I could have listened to him for another 6 hours. Fantastic interview. I think we'll keep you for about an hour today, if that's okay. But you owe us 5 more. Let's see. Turkey talks about legends, but come on, this guy is the real thing. Awesome guest, and I'm grateful to hear him speak. And here's my favorite. Get Turkey back on. I don't care if he just talks about what he ate for lunch. Just get him back on.
I haven't had lunch yet.
No, we haven't. How about breakfast?
Well, I didn't eat breakfast. I could say I had a fighter pilot breakfast.
Nice.
Coke, smoke, and...
Coke and smoke?
But, right. But I gave up cigarettes.
No, you look too healthy for that. All right. Excellent. Well, Sunshine, what are we doing today?
So today we're going to go through our listener questions. We'll be basically Jerry here, or Turkey, I should say, is in the hot seat.
That's right.
And then we'll kind of we'll ask the questions. We'll alternate. We got these questions from our listeners.
Yes.
And they span not only the past couple months, but also geographically. They're all over, right?
That's right.
We got some from the U.S. We got Australia here. So it should be a lot of fun. And so why don't we just roll into it?
I think we should. And if we want to add our own experiences where it applies and to provide a balance, because you're – a little, you know, generationally a little bit ahead of us. So maybe we can update that. So Sunshine, do you want to take the first one and say who it's from and where he's from?
Yeah. So I'm going to start off with Lee from Midway, Massachusetts. And he's going to talk about, he asks, so Jerry, does one, when using the gun, do you take into consideration the fact of whether you're over or not over a populated area? So, and he goes on to say, is for some battle, when you're battling for your life and you can't afford to take into that consideration, if someone gets hit, is it considered collateral damage? And he says he's seen some World War II movies where people are outside watching a dogfight going on in the area. This may not be the best opportunity or in their best interest. So anyway, You've been there. So tell us about using the gun over populated areas.
Well, usually if you are using the gun, it's you're over Indian country. I'm not sure I can say that now. Times have changed.
We're okay. Live, so it's out.
You're over hostile territory, and those are combatants, whether they're on the ground or whether they're in the air shooting back at you. Because mm-hmm. Usually when you are going to use weapons, deadly force has already been implemented,
right.
And you're either protecting yourself or you're trying to take somebody out.
I remember hearing and reading, and a listener actually asked once about in Honolulu during Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. Mm-hmm. A lot of the damage in Honolulu was from the Navy base firing up and it came back down. And so I hate to say it comes with the territory, but it certainly, when war happens, ugly things happen.
Yeah. It's odd you would say that. I'd like to add one small thing to that. My wife and I have had this conversation several times. I've talked to it about with my children, who are all adults as well. But war is not what people see on TV. When you really go to war, all bets are off. And it's not, I'm really upset with what you're doing. You are trying to stop things,
right.
Or to force an ideology, or you're trying to do something, and there are no rules. Anybody that thinks so is extremely naive, because you are looking. I can recall several times where it was like the old TV show 12 O'Clock High that was on. Well. Ancient show for y'all. And for me, with the flag going off, I've been there, and it's like that. Yeah. And there are people shooting at you, and you can see the sparkles. And that's every sixth, the tracers are every sixth bullet that comes up. You can see them. I mean, and it's like 4th of July, but it's daytime. You don't really think twice about it. You don't do it indiscriminately, but
The leaders who get us into war really need to be aware of that, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
Not very eloquently.
You're doing fine. I totally agree. That's another topic.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right.
So, Sunshine, with your engineering background, though, real quick back to Lee's question. A bullet that leaves the barrel is traveling very quickly.
Absolutely.
Isn't it going to, though, if it's shot several thousand feet up, slow down and before it hits the ground? I mean, it's still a hunk of metal that's going to have some speed and do some damage, but it's no longer at its muzzle velocity. It's going to reach some sort of terminal velocity, right?
Yeah, so the kinetics are a big part of it, the momentum, if you want to call it that. And yeah, usually a lot of aerial combat is done with the muzzle velocity of supersonic, right? So the bullet's going to leave the barrel supersonically, but then there's drag, right? So you're going to talk about drag, and even though your potential energy, because you're up high, so you're going to trade some of that height, if you will, or altitude for basically bullet speed as it comes down, but it's only accelerating at gravity's pace, that 9.81, right? So it's going to be decelerating, and that's a lot of the oomph is because of the velocity of the bullet. So the damage is less severe on the deck than it would be up at altitude.
Excellent.
If it hits you in the head, it's going to hurt.
It's still going to hurt. Yes.
It's going to leave a mark.
All right.
Feel it in the morning.
Next question is from Alex, who asks, in flight school, is there a way to train for the greatest possible situational awareness, or is this just a skill that needs to be given to you by birth? And before you answer that, Jerry, were you a flight instructor? I know you've done a lot of things in your career.
Yes.
Were you at some point? Did I miss that?
Yeah, every flight leader is a flight instructor.
Right.
I was in the RAG, or the replacement air group,
okay,
at Miramar for a short time before I was selected to go back to the Blues in 72.
Okay.
And so I probably had five or six hops before I selected and left.
Okay.
But in the squadron you do,
right.
I did. I flew midshipmen around after I got my wings down at Corpus Christi.
Did you make them sick?
No, actually, if I did, I'd never admit it to those guys.
Not intentionally.
I did bruise my arm real bad throwing the barf bag out the window of the T-34.
Gosh.
It was over the water.
Anyway, all right, so how about, can situational awareness be taught, or does it just come naturally, or does it come with experience?
Key being the last word.
Okay.
That's another thing most people, especially old farts like me, kind of look at the new generation when they come up. And of course, they think that we're ancient and we don't know what we're talking about. And we know they don't know what they're talking about. But the one thing that was taught to me very early on was experience is something you cannot buy. You cannot get it any way except living it. That's right. The only way.
Right.
SA or situational awareness comes from being there. It is being in the situation. You can visualize it all you want. Mm-hmm. And visualization is a phenomenal tool that can take you a long way. But visualization doesn't hurt. Not understanding where somebody is when you go to turn into them and then look and see that they're behind you instead of in front of you like you thought.
Yeah.
That SA is, that hurts.
Right.
Okay. And it can be devastating at times. So you're going to make mistakes. You remember those mistakes and hopefully learn by those mistakes. And that's why you know when the airplane pulls and it feels like that, you don't have to look and see what the speed is. You don't have to look and feel what your angle of bank or what way up is. You know that where you are in the envelope of that airplane, you just know it. It's got a feel to it. It's got a, believe it or not, it's got a smell even at times. It, you know what the airplane's doing. You just do. And you know that you're getting pretty close to not wanting to be where you're at. Or, you know, you can dig a little bit more. Sometimes you dig past because you have to.
Right.
You have to get the airplane to get where you want it to go. And there's other ways to fly out of the envelope and still be controlled. But that's the SA part. It's in a fight. You get in a fight. You guys have both been there. You've been in a 4v4 or 1v4. Yes. Well, yeah.
In our case, yeah.
Well, that's okay, though. But it's still there.
Right. Yeah.
And you know what it's like. You know, you see the guy and you know he's not a threat. You know he's going that way. So you look for the threat.
Right.
And if you've got two seats, you got somebody helping you out. We had one guy, Tom Soviet. He was, I think he was a seal of the rag at 124 and F-14s later on. It was a backseater, but he was one of the best ones I've ever flown with because you could do whatever you want until he said, God damn it. When he said, God damn it, you better do it or you're going to die. I mean, he'd go
there to turkey
dips. Yes.
He's still around, I think.
I think he is.
Yeah, yeah. I think I saw him at the Top Gun 50th.
He is a phenomenal guy. there were a couple. Jim, I can't think of Jim's last name now. He was a Rio that I fought, and I thought I was fighting the pilot. I was fighting the Rio.
He was fighting.
But he was in the back seat. He was calling the fight. He was calling where everybody was.
Yeah.
You could hear it. Boy, that guy's good.
Yeah.
Well, he was backseat.
Right.
And I had one in F-14s was equally as good. P.D. Weber, he was phenomenal.
It reminds me of the famed, 10,000 hour thing. And I equate this also to, situational awareness for pilots. But someone who is a concert pianist or a golfer, I mean, with enough practice, you're going to get that same level of proficiency in knowing where the keys are or putting a little bit of backspin on the ball or whatever it may be.
Exactly.
And so I think to your point, some people might be, as with most things, maybe quicker to adapt it than others. Mm-hmm. But I agree that it's a lot of it is just the experience.
You just have to be there to do it. You really, really do. And you have SA when you don't think about it. You've done something you didn't realize what you did.
Right. Same thing, I assume, if you just play the song and don't think about it, you're just in the zone.
Playing golf. The worst thing you can do is get in your own way playing golf. I caddied on the Pro Tour for a while years ago, and the guy told me, don't think too much. I think it hurts the team. You got to get out there and just do it. You talk about your reaction and the SA part of it, too. I had a cold cat shot. I don't know if I mentioned that. Mm-hmm. But I got it stopped because I'd gone through those procedures, and I knew what the airplane was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that I was going to stop. It was going to be close, but it was going to stop.
Well,
had I not just had that experience, it could have been a very different outcome. And it was to a guy who cruised before me. He didn't make it.
Jeez, yeah. So, wow. Moving on to the next question. Steve from London, right? So he asks, have you ever experienced a serviceability or potential fault with an aircraft type you've been flying? Which steps are taken to rectify it quickly? And does it dent your confidence in the aircraft type?
No, usually the F-8 had idiosyncrasies like that. The F-14 had them. The A-4 had them. The F-100, I got a little time in that during Vietnam with a real short exchange with the Air Force in Phan Rang. They have a thing in their airplane that when you hit burner, it sounds just like an F-8 when you have a closed nozzle. We call them closed nozzle lights, but closed nozzle lights.
Okay.
Airplane. When you went into burner, the nozzles had to open up or it was going to overtip. And the airplane had a feel and a sound. So it had come right out. You could melt the engine right there. Well, the F-100, that's their normal headshot, is that.
Yeah.
So when I was there, the takeoff, they said, okay, you got this takeoff. I think it was the second one. You know, actually, the thing. You got it. Never even been in this stupid airplane. So we got out there, had the power up, got rolling, and I went into in the burner, and the thing did, and it was that same sound. I came came to idle and boarded the takeoff.
Yeah.
Muscle memory.
It was just memory. Yeah. Yep. It's the essay of the situation. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been there and you react. Mm. And so you, after that, I learned. And the next takeoff, I didn't afford those rotten sounding takeoffs. but the FAA had very difficult to get out of a spin. But you had to do it right. If you did it right, you got out. You did it wrong, you didn't. I have
Darwinism.
Really, really, really good friends that are the best aviators I've ever flown with that lost an F8 because he got in a spin, couldn't get out. Mm. I got in one. I got a below average on that flight for reversals, but I got an above average for emergency procedure. I was able to save you.
Nice, yeah.
yes. You know, and that's as far as idiosyncrasies and deficiencies in airplanes, everyone has areas of flight or areas of the way the airplane handles or the way it was built and what it how it performs that you have to work around certain areas or you take advantage of them.
Yeah, ooh, true.
There was a legend in F-8, a guy named Joseph Trappa. We lost him last spring. Uh-huh. Joe was phenomenal. He wound up flying firefighters. Flying DC, I think through the 10, but I knew through the Stoof and a couple other airplanes. And Joe would absolutely depart the airplane in areas that nobody thought could get out of it. And then the guy do something, and then, of course, he'd come out of it, and he was behind him. I mean, I saw him do the stuff like that. Yeah, he was phenomenal.
That's great.
So, but that's, you learn the airplane, you use it. Yeah. Some people are afraid to go to that area. You learn what's there and how it can hurt you, and you avoid the hurting part, but you use it for
Yeah, I remember just to your point earlier about the different takeoffs of the different aircraft. So at the Air Force Test Pilot School, we called it negative transfer. So that's kind of bad or habits from one jet, and now you're in another jet, so now it's a bad habit, right?
Yep.
And I experienced something similar going from the S3 to the Charlie,
right.
Very different in many aspects, but then also going from the Charlie, the F-18C to the F-18E, especially around the boat.
Mm.
So pretty much, as you probably remember, with it would be water, steel, and you go to mill or blower to basically not
stay
bottom
out.
Exactly.
I did that all the time.
That's if you have a Rio.
But, so roll around to the Echo. And I had very few hours under my belt. And I did the same thing, water, steel, blower. And I took my own wave off.
Yeah.
So, so I learned different landing characteristics.
Okay.
It was a quick, steep learning curve. But by like the third, I think, time around the boat at night, or paddles, is like, come on, Sunshine. It finally kicked in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Hey, Sunshine, though, to Steve's point, red stripes, right? Those will come out from time to time.
Absolutely.
If we have a serviceability or some other fault with a fleet of aircraft. Can you describe that real quick? I know I just put you on the spot. But.
That is okay. So, case in point is going to be Basher. So, thinking back to that. So, F-14 days, we're on the Kennedy. And off of Cat 1 and F-14, the nose gear snapped off, and it was due to some internal corrosion that wasn't caught by NDI, or non-destructive inspection. And unfortunately, it was at the cost of a great American, Basher Blasham.
Yeah.
The Rio did make it, fortunately, and we interviewed him earlier.
That's right.
But what happens is they realize there's some kind of a systemic problem within the F-14s, and they weren't able to directly inspect the airframe because it was at the bottom of the ocean, but they surmised that, hey, there's some issues with the aircraft and we need to basically take a knee for the entire fleet. And they call that a red stripe. So it's an administrative message that's sent out to everybody and says, hey, you need to ground all aircraft, suspend flight ops until you do further investigation on topic A, whatever it was. Yeah.
We had the same thing in the F-8 when we first got the new engines, the P-420 engines. Mm. They were having compressor stalls and we lost two guys in the FCOP patterns, of all things, at night at San Clemente. They just went away. The airplane just boom, boom, and they went in and nobody knew
anything.
They
couldn't did they ever find them?
They found the airplanes because it's right off there.
Okay.
The guys didn't make it. I mean, they ground the airplane. One or two that happened to. And they, in fact, grounded them for a while. Until they figured out what the heck was going on. Mm-hmm. And it was what they did to get more thrust out of the engines wasn't beef anything up. They just raised the temperature of the EGT and it sort of blew up some turbines. So.
Well, and to Steve's point, does that dent your confidence in the aircraft type? Mm-hmm. Steve, I would say it actually gives me more confidence in the system overall because it means we're doing those inspections. We're finding out why things happen. And then we're not just sugarcoating or looking over it. We're saying, hey, you know what? This needs to be fixed and let's fix it. And me personally, it never dented my confidence when this came out, like on the F-18.
No, I totally agree that for me, an emergency was a chance to learn more about the system. Right.
Yep.
So, troubleshooting and also just reacting to the system malfunction, for next time. this is how that system works.
Yep. All right. So Alex has another question, Turkey. Mm-hmm. What was the most intense moment you ever had while flying alone in the cockpit?
Well, that's a good one. Well, for an F-8 pilot, that's kind of an oxymoron. If there was somebody else in there, you're in trouble. But I'll be honest with you. I can't put a finger on one.
Okay.
The one that comes to mind, one of them, I was flying at 42,000 feet. I hated oxygen masks. It's like the movie The Aliens, that big thing.
Stuck on your face.
So every once in a while, I'd take it off for a while, and I'd put it back on. Well, I had taken mine off. And it was this way.
Right.
And I had a generator that cycled off. And I'm on a cross country. I mean, we cruised at 43.9, I think it was. When the thing went off, I knew it was right down here. I reached down to cycle the generator. Well, it was the generator, the cabin dump, and some other switch.
Oh,
you see where this is going?
I do.
Yeah. The cabin dump in the F-8 is just a little square thing that sits right here, and it opens up to the outside, and the cabin dumps out that hole. So I reached down to grab that thing, and I thought I found the edge, and I went and I turned it off, and all of a sudden it opened up and dumped the cabin.
Oof.
And of course, you know, at 43,000 feet, you're on pressure breathing.
Yeah.
Well, I turned the oxygen was there, but it was just kind of blowing. And then, boy, when it go to the cabin gets to 43,000 feet, I did have an alien that was just beating the snot out of me. That thing was just all over. I was trying to get a hold of it. My eardrums were laying on my shoulder. It fogged up immediately. I couldn't see anything in the cockpit. And so the first thing I finally did is I got the mask on and got that thing over there. And I cycled the generator and it came back on. And then I closed the cabin and it closed down. And I got my voice under control. I'm okay.
All your body parts where they're supposed to be.
Yeah. That goes along with a lot of the other questions that are here. Mm-hmm. I learned a lesson from that.
Yes.
I still took my mask off at times, but I did it the other way I could see.
Uh-huh.
And I was much more cautious about just grabbing switches and throwing without looking. That comes from being a little overconfident. That was just one of them. My last flight in training command. It was an I-11. It was a strafe hop, low angle strafe hop, which they don't teach, I don't think, that much low angle stuff anymore. But mom and dad and my sister were there to put my wings on that afternoon. My dad had my wings on. And one of the things they warned you about is target fixation. And I started pressing the target, wanted to get good hits and do well on my last flight. And all of a sudden, I realized I'm in trouble. And I full power. I'm in an F9 Cougar. Full power, pull the stick, not hard back, but just pull it back. And I can, this minute, remember seeing tumbleweeds.
In your periphery?
In the peripheral vision.
Wow.
So, I mean, I was in the dirt, but I got it back up and went back in the pattern. And the instructor was there, but he was in a position where he couldn't see me. And I've done pretty well. But that would have been very embarrassing at the beginning.
At the least.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention possibly tragic. So target fixation for everybody home. Let's say we're attacking this microphone. You normally come in, you attack, and then off you go. Well, target fixation, as the name implies, and maybe it's not worth pointing out, but you just keep flying so close. And certainly people have proven one way to take out the target is to just collide with it.
One big hit.
But not ideal for prolonged living. All right. Sunshine, do you have an intense moment alone in the cockpit you want to share quickly with us?
So there have been a couple, obviously, but for me, it was an F-18C. There was a dust storm in the Persian Gulf, and it was so intense that it had grounded the Air Force assets. Mm. So just they had launched the carrier guys, and we had to fill in for the close air support missions for the Air Force. Anyway, on the way back, I couldn't see the carrier. And this is when I didn't know about cage on cage with the ghost philosophy.
Ah.
So anyway, basically a shortfall in my training or my learning, really, with the systems in the jet. So I am basically about 15, 18 seconds where we normally call the ball, and I can't see the carrier at all. So it's Claris ship is the term we use there. And I broke out probably halfway down the ramp, down the groove, excuse me, so about 7 seconds. And when I broke out and saw the carrier, I was actually lined up on the island, not lined up on the landing area.
Okay.
So I got a scream out of paddles because they saw me basically the same time I saw them. And then I pucker factor was high, obviously. I was didn't talk like a schoolgirl, but I would have had I mentioned anything on
the radio. If you listen to the tape, you may have.
I blocked that out. Yeah. Anyway, so I actually had to go up the starboard side or the right side of the ship, which is usually predominantly a no-no, if you will.
And then do it again.
And then I had to come around. Yes, you're right. And the worst part, Jerry, is I'm like, what? This is such a dumb job. Why am I doing this? You know what I'm saying? So I had to talk myself down and then build my confidence back up while I'm turning downwind, if it makes sense, to come back in. So that was my story.
Was that daytime or nighttime?
That was daytime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I think there's a video floating around YouTube of all you see is the HUD symbology and just gray. Yeah. And all of a sudden the ship kind of appears, the guy lands. So, yeah.
Screaming like a schoolgirl? That might be my footage.
Funny enough, for three naval aviators, mine also includes carrier landing, and I don't have to go into great detail because it's chronicled in the PBS special Carrier, the night pitching deck one. Yeah, so people often ask me, hey, did you know you're on this show? Yes, I do. It's not a thing I'll forget, but for your sake, Turkey, long story short, off the coast of Australia, plus or minus 20 feet, and three passes to get aboard. First one missed everything. Second one missed the wires. Third one did a quick AOA excursion to drop the hook and grab the fore.
And you got
The hardest part besides that, though, was taxiing because my legs were shaking so bad. The adrenaline was like, okay, I'm done here. I need to go out. I'll go through your muscles. And so that made it difficult to control the rudders and the brakes. And then I walk into the radar room and everybody, yay! And then the camera's like, hey, how was that?
Like, so,
that was my most intense moment.
I think we all have those moments. I was coming aboard the Hancock off the coast of Japan, and you could see the screws of the ship. And then you could see it plan for them. I can remember coming around. And I actually, as an LSO, I had to weigh people in that, too. And I used the call, you sound good, keep it coming.
Oh, jeez.
I couldn't see them. You had them turn on a landing light or a taxi light so you can see something in there. When you're blue water, it's better.
That's what you got to do. Reject.
And at the risk of waxing poetic for a moment, there are men and women out doing this very thing right now around the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are done. At least I'm speaking for myself.
I've hung it up. They're much smarter, faster people than I.
Yeah.
Great. So you know what? I'm actually going to – well, okay, let's go in order here. So Rob Evans from Seattle, Washington asks – Turkey, what is your perspective on dogfighting in a P-40 or an F-4 or a P-51, et cetera? Basically, more modern aircraft versus the historical aircraft. Can we say nowadays that the modern aircraft can really dogfight in the traditional sense?
Anybody that's been in one knows they can. It can still be a knife fight. I mean, I have been in things where you are four airplanes from a guy climbing vertical canopy to canopy. You can see them over there, and you're waiting for somebody to make a mistake or to fall off. The first one that falls off dies. I mean, in a training environment,
sure.
Loses.
Right.
But yes, I always thought, and I said it out loud several times, I always thought I was born too late. I wanted to fly the F-4 Corsair so bad. That, to me, was a fighter. Yeah. That was a fighter aircraft. Yeah. The F-8 to me was the one thing that was the more modern version of that. To me, it was an absolute. It was a gunfighter. You got into a knife fight. You could do whatever you needed with it. You could make it work for you if you knew how to work the airplane. And the guys, by and large, probably 99% of them could. I mean, every fight was nothing was a given. In my mind, it was. I was not going to lose.
Sure.
But everybody had the same attitude, and they were very, very proficient. It was spread out more. You started, a couple, 3 miles apart. You turned in, and you passed that on. You passed that on from here to the door over there, or closer. I mean, we've been very close, and you see it's going to blank.
Right.
It was great. Great fun. You watch them turn, see which way they turn, and then you do something they don't expect.
Yeah.
You try, you know.
Well, and I wonder if Robert's question is really meaning, in other words, obviously any two aircraft can twirl and fight, short of giant, airliners and whatnot.
They get bigger.
But I wonder if Robert's really getting at, with a helmet-mounted sight and a high foresight weapon, is it really dogfighting anymore? If you can just look at the guy and shoot him, right? So if that is your question, Robert, well, I mean, we still train to, even today, dogfighting in all these aircraft that you listed, because we want those skills. You want to have that aviation airmanship. And frankly, you could be out of missiles or you could have a problem. And so you still need to know how to maneuver, to your point, from possibly a neutral pass to now I'm behind you and I can employ the gun if I have one.
My not to interrupt.
No, please.
And my idea, shooting BVR beyond visual range is not a dogfight. That's
right.
That's an encounter with an enemy. When you dogfight, you are mono or a femono. I don't know what they say that now, but you're fighting another person. You are reacting and causing, trying to cause harm to another person. God, I had a point and it slipped. It'll come back. I'll interrupt somebody else here in a minute.
While you dig for it. To Jella's point, so to me, BFM was, I called it advanced handling characteristics. I'm sure a lot of folks did. But it was a chance, an opportunity for you. Yes, you're going to react with the guy around you and try to identify geometry and intercept and all that stuff. But for me, it was learning how to really fly this plane, which you talked about earlier. I mean, slow speed characteristics, but you're up at altitude. And there's times when stalls and stall indications, not necessarily gauges, if you will, but just vibrations, senses, noises, smells, anything like that, has actually, I kind of parlayed it into the landing pattern, because in the T-38 Air Force, in the landing pattern, they, from my limited perspective, they tend to fly it slower than I'd like. So it's closer to stall. Their stall margin is reduced, which is not a good thing in a little delta wing fighter, right? Anyway, point being is I flew it up at altitude and kind of understood some of the stall characteristics and indications other than the gauges. And when I got in the landing pattern, one time I noticed some of those stall indications that was not a gauge, but it was a buffet on the wings. And so I kind of parlayed that BFM stuff, if you will, into the landing pattern, and it helped out. So advanced handling characteristics.
Yeah. I did think.
Did
I
remember, was that perfect time?
It was great. I really appreciate the
left.
It was our
left.
When you talk about how a dogfight in modern times is when all else fails, you may be stuck with just you and him without bullets, without sight. In the F-8 TAC manual, I believe it was, or the confidential supplement, there actually was a paragraph that addressed that issue. And if you were in that situation, you were to drop your hook and speed brakes and ram him.
Wow.
In the book. So
do what it takes.
That is an attitude that carried into that that group of people into that fraternity that permeated the whole fraternity. I mean, that's the way you looked at it. Bottom line, you're not going to lose. You're not going to lose.
Well, you're going to lose or die. I mean, if you lose, you die, right?
Depending on perspective, depends on the importance of what you're there for to protect. And what it means to you,
yes.
I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical.
No, understood. But the ultimate price, codified in a manual. That's
crazy. And I also, while I'm at it, there is a, and I think it was on the F-4 manual. It might have been the F-8 manual, but it showed the ship. Maybe it was the LSO manual, but it showed the ship and two F-4s with their hook down. And if you look on the wing, it said U.S. Air Force, U.S. Air Force. And you look at the ship, and it had the captain's gig leaving. It had people going down ropes, and they were rolling to come in the ship in section.
That's right. Yeah, so I have seen that one.
I got one somewhere at home.
People abandoned the ship.
It was hilarious.
Excellent. All right, moving on. Elliot from the U.K. This one could probably be a little bit quicker. Squadron helmets. They usually look to have white tape over them, with squadron colors and emblems and a pilot's call sign. And today, that's certainly the case. Is this done by the squadron, and can you personalize it in any way?
As a student, you can. When you're younger, you can, basically. The idea behind that, it's all reflective tape.
Right.
And it's so that if you're in the water at night and there's just any light comes over, they can see. That's the only reason for that tape in the first place. In the squadrons, not so much. I mean, you'll get your name, but the squadrons have a basic pattern that they do. I mean, it would look kind of funny when I was on the Blues, everybody with a gold helmet, and I had a silver one. I went my own way a lot of times, but I don't think that would have worked out. All squadrons are that way. The F1 was that way. It had a wolf on the side for the wolf pack. I don't ever remember seeing, other than a new guy came in or somebody that was.
And then
just,
they updated it to
then
the
they updated as soon as they could. That's
right.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. The only thing I had a number, 50, it got up to 15. It was my just little tribute to the friends that I'd lost in the business. So every once in a while, you could put like someone who put their state flag real small or something.
Yeah. But we all did.
Something
the same. Did you have tick marks or a number?
No, just a number.
You
if I heard of someone passing or, God forbid, observed it, I would just ask the PRs to update it by one. And the last one, one I have on my refrigerator in the garage right now has a 15. So I think that's where I left off. So,
yeah.
All right, Sunshine, you want to take the next one?
Absolutely. So Chris Dean from Canada states, I was just curious on what your guys' thoughts are on the Sukhoi airframes. How do they compare to the North American airframes and the such? I always thought they were a good-looking airframe and very capable, but Chris is saying he's not a pilot. So Sukhoi, what do you think of that?
Well, I think the Russian aircraft were, they approached design differently than we did. They really didn't approach it for looks. They also didn't approach it for ergonomics. They approached it for doing what they want to get done.
Right.
The performance of the aircraft in certain realms. They picked up, and they would make it that way. You sit in the cockpit of one of those things, and they're very primitive. Very primitive. I thought they were nice looking airplanes. They always look good in front of me. Of course, in real life, I had one bad guy in front of me. But
you were very effective.
I was just luckier than heck for that to happen, to be honest with you. They're very good airplanes. You can't argue with them. Most of the stuff, the guts and the weight, a lot of those things were working. Even had the same mistakes in design that they had when they were on our airplanes, when they put them on their airplanes, because they stole a lot of that stuff.
Reverse engineered.
Yes.
We don't know why this is this way. We'll just make it that way also.
It works Stalin. Yeah, Stalin's policy was crazy about that. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Oh, yeah. On the outside, they may look different, but that was an awful lot of American ingenuity in almost every Russian airplane.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of the early MiGs and Russian aircraft were also designed with the purpose built. In other words, the MiG-29 even was intended to possibly advance in a war on the Eastern Front, perhaps, in a Cold War, so that the landing gear was beefed up. They had fog-protecting screens for the intakes. And another thing that's interesting about those aircraft, not so much anymore, but they were designed for very GCI dependent pilots. So in other words, they didn't give their pilots the autonomy that we had. They had pilots that said, look, you're going to get up there and you're going to do what we tell you. You're going to fly this heading, this airspeed, you're going to intercept the guy, almost like an extension of an airborne, let's say, part of the IADS, integrated air defense, almost like an airborne SAM shooter. But now, of course, especially with the SU-30, they've really gotten away to that and gotten away from that, and a lot more autonomy in the aircraft.
We've gone the same way.
Yeah.
Very much so. All of our airplanes, look at the A-4. The A-4 was built as a throwaway one-trip airplane.
Right.
And what was that one trip for?
To drop a nuclear weapon.
That's why the landing gear is so tall, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Crazy.
And now, look, everything has to do everything now, and that's why they're so darn expensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they don't do anything exceptional.
True.
They do everything well,
right.
Pretty much. But nothing exceptional.
Well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that Russian philosophy carried over to everybody they gave the airplanes to.
That's right.
The guy that I got, that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. That's why he jumped up, because his orders were to engage us, and he realized he was not going to make it. He left. But it was all under control, nothing autonomous. And we were basically autonomous. Once they said, there they are, and we caught a glint, that was it. There was nothing more there. We were allowed to do whatever we needed to get the job done.
Yeah, just along with that Russian design philosophy of brute force as opposed to elegance.
Yeah,
I think of the MiG-25. Never flew it, obviously, but it was really good at straight line interception.
Real fast.
Go. Yeah. I did get to fly the MiG-15.
Okay.
And now, granted, that's a very old aircraft, but it was built. It didn't trust the pilot. It was built for a student pilot, say, or someone who was going to forget things, and had a lot of redundancy, a lot of mechanical redundancy. So you drop the landing gear, and you'd have your light indications in the cockpit, but you'd also have little posts on the wings that would tell you that the gear is down and locked. And apparently, the way it was designed also is that structurally, it could land gear up, and they expected it to happen, and they could just salvage the aircraft as opposed to
just lift it up, lower the gear.
Yeah, and I think it was because they didn't kind of trust the training or whatever you want to call it of the pilot. So,
did you ever hear of Grumman?
Yeah.
Grumman Ironworks?
Yes.
We had an airplane. The guy jumped out of it. The airplane landed itself in the King Ranch. They went out. Put it on the truck.
What kind of airplane was it?
It was an F-9.
F-9, yeah. There's a picture of it landed in some field, right?
Yeah, the King Ranch in South Texas, south of Kingsville.
No.
Yeah, on its own. I mean, the guy was out of control, and he jumped out, and that stabilized everything.
It's thing just landed itself.
Landed itself.
Variables are gone. That's nice and stable now.
Yeah, there you go.
It always smelled like dirt and cow shit. But
but speaking of smell of aircraft.
Oh, yeah, we're getting to that.
Let's go back to that question.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, let's move on. Elliot again from the UK. Do you guys get cold? Seems a little menial, but I realize that I don't really know how you moderate temperature in the cockpit, depending on weather and altitude, etc.
Yeah, yes, you get cold, and you reach down and you turn the volume of the heat. We actually do have it's bleed air comes off the engine. It goes through a heat exchanger, and you it feeds that into air conditioned air, and you can manipulate the temperature in the cockpit to where it's comfortable.
Was the F8 decent on the deck though, or did you,
It was okay. Yeah, it's such a small cockpit; it wasn't much to cool or heat. We didn't do anything real cold.
Yeah, so that sounds like it hasn't changed a whole lot because the F-18 was the same way. And I remember, Sunshine, maybe you do too, in the Gulf, you'd be pre-flighting on the carrier deck. You'd be hot and sweaty.
Right.
You get in the airplane, you get to altitude, now you have wet clothes against you.
Yeah. Or ice,
Or and then the air conditioning's working, so you get cold.
Yeah.
So, yes, you do, Elliot. You do get hot and cold, and you can moderate the temperature. And usually it works pretty well.
Indeed. Indeed it does, yeah. And then Elliot continues on to say, so what happens to WISOs, the weapons system operators, or REOs, or backseaters, if you will, and they're like the EA-6, EA-6B, when their platform is retired? So he imagines that the pilots can retrain, but is it more difficult for the backseaters to find an additional role either in the air or in the military?
Now, do you want that politically correct or the fire pilot?
Let's go.
Let's see. We have 33 people, so it depends on how many you want.
Go for it. Go for it.
Who cares?
No, we're down to three.
That's right. My reel just hung up. They are as required and important in modern warfare as the pilot is.
Yeah.
And they are very, very, very smart people. Mm-hmm. They retrain them from one airplane to another. They're constantly changing equipment anyway, so you're always learning something new on new equipment. Eventually, they promote out of that anyway, and they get into leadership positions that are non-flying positions. That was ahead of all of us back in those days. Some guys like Cag Waples and some other people like that flew their whole career. They never stopped. Other people got caught later on when they got more senior.
Aged out of the cockpit. You're right.
It happens. Remember Dave Slayton? He was our guest on the S3 episode. Yeah, he went from the P3 as enlisted man, which didn't go away, but then he was commissioned S3. But then as that started to go away, he transitioned to the Prowler. But to be fair, the naval flight officer tactically in the military these days seems to almost be a dying breed because everything's going to single seat. Now, we don't have the F-22, but that's only single seat. F-35 is only single seat. Mm-hmm. So we'll still have the Super Hornet for a long time. But it seems like there's fewer, certainly, on carrier now than there ever used to be.
Yeah, so you got the WISOs kind of, I don't want to say aging out, but yeah. Right. But also the pilot concept is coming around the corner. So
That's true. Well, we do have the Growler too. I need to make sure.
Oh, that's true.
I was just going to say, PD Weber, that guy I told you about, was my Rio in the F-14s.
Yeah.
PD's in that program. It's the pilotless fighter, and as a backseater, is one of the guys. Taking it to the ship. They've proven its capabilities in dogfighting. I obviously didn't train him with the crap, but the he knows what he's doing. And
is this loyal wingman program with Boeing, or
I can't answer who that is. I just can't remember what company. He's kind of on a sub now, but it wasn't Boeing though. Okay. I think it might have been Northrop. He's working with
their own version.
They're doing wonderful things with it. And the funny thing about it is me being an LSO, I harped on it a lot, and he took a lot of that with him. Talked to the people about the LSOs. He's gone to LSO meetings, and he actually was listening to me at times because some of the things that I thought was very important, he got into that program, and I'm really, really proud of him for what he's done. He's really done a good job.
Excellent. You bring up a great point of just relationships. So as we see technology expand, you know, it's not about, I don't think, me personally, so I don't think it's about the acumen of computing speed or technical acumen, let's say, but it's more about the relationship. And you brought up a great point. You know, your buddy listened to you, and then he passed it on. And I mean, how do we get to the moon? It was a series of relationships with NASA, right?
You know the average age of the people that worked in the command center on the moon landing?
No.
27 years old.
Wow.
The only reason I know this is because I was just watching all those specials. It's the 40th anniversary.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's right.
July 29th.
I just got my wings. We were in Corpus Christi when they landed on the moon. I was flying meetings around with that.
Okay,
time.
Yeah.
And so that time meant a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be one. I got offered PG school or the Blues at the same time. And I got greedy and took the Blues instead of going to PG school.
Don't blame it.
I had my app in the astronaut program from day one, from the day I signed up to be an aviator. I put my name in it.
Yeah.
Really wanted to do that. You're absolutely right. He just called me last week. PD did.
Okay.
And we talked for over an hour.
Yeah.
My roommate in Vietnam is, I married his cousin. I mean, there are relationships that never go away. I still, there's a flight surgeon, I think he's in Jackson Hole, a guy named Rick Sugden. Just heard about him the other day through the chief pilot I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
He was going up to see him. And Rick's brother-in-law was Boomer Wilson, who I knew from, he left the F1 as I came in. We had a guy working for, I was flying corporate for a while, a guy named Beaker, Wright was his last name. His dad, Mo Wright, was one of my instructors in flight training. And yeah, I was working for him in the corporate world here after he retired as an F-18 senior.
Okay.
So, I probably is. He was a good guy.
Did he look like Beaker?
Yes, he did.
That's him.
All right. Kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always say people join the military to fly jets. Mm-hmm. They stay because of the people.
Yeah.
And that's because you do it, you enjoy it, but really it's the relationships. And even my wife will sometimes say, I miss being part of the spouses club, or, you know, like at the airlines, you don't really have that shared sense of burden. They don't get together and go do fun things with the kids. So we miss it, and it's all around.
Yeah.
Now, Sunshine, for this next question, I should probably remind everyone that the Fighter Pilot Podcast is about the aircraft, the weapon systems, and the people. Well, people come in many different shapes and sizes, and there's pretty parts and there's ugly parts, and there's things that we do that are a little less glamorous. So with that in mind, Mauricio Mr. Ping Fernando asks, from the non-fighter pilot point of view, we get an idea of what life in the cockpit might be like. We see flight videos, we hear the sounds, we can taste some of the food you get, we can even explain the strain of G-forces on your body, but one part is not mentioned, he says. What does it smell like? Are all the planes the same due to the oxygen systems? Is there an unwritten rules for two-seat planes about in-flight flatulence? He says farting, but I'll use my public education there. Can you even smell the guy in the back seat if you didn't shower? Great question, Mr. Ping. Haven't had that one yet in a year and a half of running this show. You've got some two-seat time.
Well, I always thought the best defense is a good offense.
You're sitting upwind.
That's right. And
not always. There was one airplane where it went from back to front. I can't remember which one.
Really?
Was it the Super on it? Because I knew I flew it, whichever one it was. And that the person in back could really clobber the pilot. I'm sorry to hijack the discussion.
No,
it was bad. I was like, you might want to put your mask on.
Well, that's a good one.
I think it was the Super Hornet.
Yeah.
So maybe someone could help us out. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, there's nothing to be sorry about.
Well, the point simply was that it was hard to fight upstream.
That's right. Well, and that's absolutely correct. Most airplanes actually sit with the backseaters a little higher anyway. So, and everything that rises. So that's his problem, not mine.
98.6.
But we do have oxygen. Oxygen is fairly pristine smelling. Yeah, you can't smell it. It's completely odorless. So it gets worse. Bad enough in there. You would put that on. And usually you're flying with it anyway, so you wouldn't really notice it that
much.
Unless it was extremely pungent, but never really had a problem. Plus, most of my time was single seats.
Right.
Who did it? Oh, it was me. Yeah.
Well, but the airplane, besides flatulence, the airplanes do have a smell about them, just like a car does, or if you go to your parents' house. And I miss it. You know, sometimes if I'm, for whatever reason, rummaging through my old stuff, especially if you have stuff from the boat has its own smell, too.
Oh, it doesn't.
But, you know, it's part of it. And did either of you ever get to fly a brand new airplane, like with that new car smell? Now, new cars have a lot of their smell because of the plastics that they use.
Yeah,
totally. But we don't have as much of that. But I do remember flying a relatively new Super Hornet, and something about the seat had a new smell, and I was amazed, because prior to that, all I flew was old F-18s.
Oh, yeah. So, we at the VX-31, we had a 50-hour Super Hornet Echo model.
Okay.
And it was clean. Didn't have pylons, had nothing on it. So it was a rocket ship, and we used it for proficiency.
Uh-huh.
So we'd basically go out and do mock dives and see how fast we could get, pushing the limit. And anyway, I just remember walking up to it, and the landing gear was pristine. And that was the first thing I noticed, because usually the white paint is all chipped and dirty anyway. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. None of that. And then you get in the cockpit, and There was a little bit of a new car smell, just a tad. It was pretty nice. So I don't know about you, Jerry.
I flew the F-18. It was nothing new about that. In the F-14, I think we had a couple, when we started getting Block 85s out. Block 65 is what I went through training with in the F-14, and then we got 85s. And they wound up 105s and 120s, I think, later. I think the highest I ever got was a 105. And we had some new ones there. And they did. They had a new smell.
Okay.
There was a smell about airplanes that actually, one that stands out more than anything is cordite. After shooting the guns, it's an ammonia type smell that was, every time I catch a whiff of it, I get reminded of combat. I really do.
Yeah.
Because anytime you shot the guns that way, and over there we did a lot. I mean, we actually did strafing and other things as well. Air-wise, not so much.
Smell has an interesting way. I'm not a scientist, but of
it does
triggering certain memories.
I was going to say, your first girlfriend, you probably remember her perfume. And if you smell it out at the mall, sorry, why?
You better stop.
Yeah, I know. No, but you're right. The sense of smell is strongly tied to memory.
It is.
That's a great point.
We're about 13 minutes to go here, all right. Sunshine. So we got time for a couple
more. Let's see.
I think the left-handed is a good.
Right, good.
I mean, it's a good question.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And they all are, but this is let's highlight this one. So Ashley from Melbourne, Australia. So good day. Asks, how close in dogfights? Did I read the wrong one?
Well, that's a good one too. But
My apologies. Sorry about that. Ashley, we'll get to you shortly. Chris Kelly from Georgia. Thank you very much, Turkey. Growing up left-handed, I was always compromising on daily tasks, writing notebooks, chalkboards, using scissors, etc. Also, I was usually the only lefty in my classes and sports team from elementary through high school. However, in my engineering career, there are a higher concentration of lefties, and it is common to have left-handed colleagues. Or he asked, is it common to have left-handed colleagues? Since there's a concentration of engineers in military aviation, were there many lefties in the flying community? And he also asked, were there any compromises required for left-handed aviators?
To answer the last part, no. There was nothing done just for left-handed guys. Mm-hmm. They're designed, you fly the airplane in your right hand, and the throttle's in your left hand. Mm-hmm. If it's the other way around, you're in backwards. So,
turn around.
It's very uncomfortable.
Darn it, I did it again.
They react. You learn how to do it. You really do.
Yeah. But both hands are busy, too.
Oh, very busy. It's not that one just sits there. Yeah.
They're busy, but okay, Jerry, picture at night, you got martial instructions.
So that's tough.
You're right.
That's a good point.
I would rather be a lefty at this point because you could still fly and write with your left hand, whereas I had to start to fly with either my knees, or the autopilot, or fly with the left hand and write with the right hand for marshalling and all sorts of, tanker.
If it was complicated, that's what you had to do.
Yeah.
You just grabbed it and leave the throttle alone.
That's right.
You got knee boards. I mean, that's what we had, knee boards that you could write on. But you're right. That's
so that would be one advantage, I guess, the lefty.
And I think pilots just have to adapt because even in the airlines, the Airbuses and other aircraft, in the first officer who sits to the right has a right-handed control. Mm-hmm. And the captain who sits on the left has a left-handed control.
Never upgrade.
You were 737s.
That's right. I didn't have to wait.
Yeah. So presumably, right-handed pilots as captains have to adapt. And I think it's just something your body just says, okay, this is what I need to do. I'm going to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. That's right.
But for sure, the tactile feel is different.
And something that was implied in his question as well says there's a higher concentration of engineers in military aviation. There may be now, but there wasn't when I started. I mean, my best friend was an animal husbandry major and a religion major. Eric Burns was a religion major, and he was one of the best I've ever flown with.
Yeah.
They went into the scientific time about 75 or so. I remember coming back. I'd gotten out of the Navy for a little time, and when I came back in, when I left, when you go to the club, everything was Corvettes there were a few Mustangs and stuff around. But there were neat cars in there. You came back, there were Yugos and Volkswagen Bugs and crap, and it was kind of embarrassing to go to the club. I parked across the street. I am an engineer. So.
I'm outnumbered here. All right, so let's see. We'll keep moving here. So Ashley from Melbourne, Australia says, how do close-in dogfights work at night? Does it ever happen in combat? And do you train at night for it? I can imagine this is very dangerous. This is the key part. I can imagine this is very dangerous. It will be difficult to train to.
I think the bravest thing I ever did was, do some acrobatics at night. Okay. But doing dogfight at night, that's what beyond visual range is for, so it's radars for. If he's that dumb to try to get you at night, he's going to run into something. He's not going to make it home anyway. So, we didn't ever do it. We just didn't. I had to fly at night.
Right.
I shot the guns at night.
Yeah,
I think I told you that.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to do it.
But that's it. We didn't. You didn't dogfight. How about you guys?
So for me, it's ORM, operational risk manager, right? So if I can get the job done without exposing myself to too much risk, in this case, dogfighting at night, then totally with Jerry. VBR and then go home.
How many things give me the heebie-jeebies with that?
Yeah. Dogfighting at night.
Actually, in training, for example, in large force exercises up in Fallon, Nevada, East of Reno, they have 180 degrees turn limitation. So if you end up at a merge with a live adversary, you can turn a little bit. The idea being that in that amount of time, if you were to continue to visually maintain sight of the adversary, then you could hopefully employ a weapon. But no, we don't go out and do full. In fact, you have to stop dogfighting within 30 minutes of sunset.
That's right.
And no sooner than 30 minutes after sunrise because of the low sun angle and other things. In World War II, I believe there were some night fighters that had clothes within guns range, but it wasn't dogfighting.
No, it was radar. They had radar and the things. They were the only ones that had it.
Okay.
One thing we used to do at night, if you did anything over Indian country or over bad guy territory, you turned your lights out too. And I mean, you were invisible.
Right.
Yeah.
There's nothing. You can't see anything. It's all red lights in the cockpit, and that wavelength doesn't travel in very far. Nobody can see you.
Yeah.
So, and I've done that to people, guys coming in on rendezvous just to get their attention at time, a night rendezvous, and have him get close, and he looks away. You can tell when he gets close because his wings are just turn the lights out. And gee,
And I think for us in theater, it was because basically it was a very permissive environment. The air picture was resolved already, but I kept my lights on. Very different. It makes sense what you did yours for. But basically in Iraq and Afghanistan, my concern was running into allied aircraft,
Which
happens. So I keep those strobes and smashers and all that, the nav lights on, unless if we were getting shot at directly. Say we're orbiting for close air support. I got shot at once. I did turn off lights, but my wingman had an altitude separation. It was all very planned and we'll call it scripted, if you will.
But we were there. We had there was nobody else flying. I mean, we were it.
Yeah,
and you're one carrier up there flying at night.
Yeah.
So that guy and me are the only ones airborne in the tank.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe, anything to add with the lights at night?
No, not really. Nope, it is what it is.
Okay.
You want to finish with Jax? I think that's a good one, and we'll have to keep it fairly brief, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, so Jack LaRoe from Suwanee, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
He asks, what was the most defining learning experience in your career as a fighter pilot that you have to take a step back and think to yourself, geez, that was close, or I should have known better about a certain situation or experience, and how did you tackle it moving forward?
Well, I mentioned that about my I-11 hop, my strafe hop. That was one.
The target fixation.
That was the first one that really, really brought it home. There were several other, every aviator, and if you get, 20,000 hours or so, every aviator with that much time, I guarantee you, has done some stupid things. Lapses in concentration. It just happens. And if you don't take them as learning experiences and as life moment changes, you take a chance of not having another one.
Yeah. Very true.
To remember. Yeah. So you have to learn by those.
Yeah.
I've had a bunch we haven't even talked about yet.
Yeah, you've had a lifetime of them, I'm sure.
One that was kind of fun they might enjoy. We had transitioned to the A4 in the Blues. We were out flying inverted. We hadn't changed the tanks yet, and the A4 had a tank that's about that big, and it had flapper valves on it. And when you went upside down, flapper valves closed and trapped a minute of gas at normal power setting. Well, I rolled an inverted, and I'm 400 knots or so, and I'm right about center point in El Centro, and all of a sudden the engine quit.
The engine.
Yeah.
Singular. The loudest quiet you have ever heard in your life.
Loudest quiet.
Nice. And once again, it's a reactive thing. You don't think about it. It's easy to know what to do close to the ground like that and upside down. You don't pull. You push. So you pushed out that right side up, came around the horn, which means you pulled power around the horn. That's how you relit it.
Correct.
Hit bang, hit the igniters, came back, and it started. So I'm pointing to the field, went back and landed. As it turns out, that when they took it apart and looked, and that thing had like six flapper valves. Well, three of them had broke the springs that allowed them to do this stuff had broken and stuck open. So all the fuel ran out when it was upside down. And so it was just fuel starvation is what it was.
Yeah.
Well, we had learning one. You know, it wasn't certified for that. It hadn't been checked for that yet, you know, for that length of time. Mm-hmm. So I shouldn't have been doing it. So I didn't.
Sunshine, any Jello? Quick...
yours first. Yeah, okay, sure. Learning experiences?
You know, the one that comes to mind, and I've shared it on the podcast before, is I had a cut pass for power on the wires.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, I just thought that I kept going into afterburner, and thank you. As an LSO. I was young. It wasn't my cat ops tour, please. But certainly that was a geez that was close, because had I trickled off the end, I'd been wet or dead. And it was just unnecessary. And it was unfortunate because, you know, it's one of these, it wasn't like I took a chance on purpose. It was just, what was I thinking? Why did I do that? And never did it again and got decent later. I snuck into the top 10 a couple times in my career. So
nice.
But that was one.
Yeah. For me, it was an S3s, and I'm supposed to drop some flares for an F-14, who's my buddy from the Academy, Ed Sheehy there. So anyway, he's in the F-14, always wanted to fly it, never got to. And it turns out it's dusk. So basically up high, we're in the sunlight coming down low. Now it's dark. I'm still admiring the Tomcat. Meanwhile, the water's coming up. So poor, poor choice on my part to look left when I should have been staring at my gauges. I got really low, almost ran into the water. And that was a very big learning experience.
How about a crewman there helping you out?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know who it was sitting in the right, but he.
But his eyes were about that big.
He couldn't say anything.
The most dangerous thing there is to fly over water.
Oh, yes.
Especially low altitude. It's the most dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's hard to discern for everyone else.
Yeah.
We all know it. We're all nodding. But for everyone else, especially at night, sky, ground, water, ground is clear, but sky, water, very difficult.
It's all right. Time, because I have one of those too. So.
All right. Well, people have said they'd like you to come back. In fact, there's one year I skipped. I could spend all day listening to his stories. Or reading them. Hint, hint.
No. Oh. Yeah. Huh?
I've started a couple of times. I'm looking for a good ghoster now.
Okay. All right.
Well, that stuff.
Jerry, we have about run out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time today and being here.
Absolute pleasure.
Good. Sunshine, what's some parting thoughts, shots? What?
Things like this, it's just a great, I just thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, for sure.
And the honor. It's my pleasure here.
All right. Well, so we want to, you know, you're used to being paid for your time as an airline captain. You probably made several hundred dollars an hour. Well, for your hour, we're giving you one of our new fancy, everyone at home, this is now a patch of the Fighter Pilot Podcast, worth at least as much as an hour of captain time.
Absolutely.
But we want to present, this is our first one to give away.
Really?
But for everyone else, if you head on over to patreon.com and sign up, if you reach certain milestones, we're going to start sending these out to our supporters. Just a little plug there for Patreon. But no, we want to offer you one. Don't expect to see it on your jacket, but find a fun place, or if you've got a nephew who enjoys these kinds of things, please share it with him or her. But thanks very much for your time today.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you. My pleasure.
And everyone else back home, thanks very much. Sunshine, we almost got caught up on questions.
Kind of nice.
But we have a lot of audio telephone call questions, so we'll do those on the next episode. By the way, which is on the F4. So I don't know if you know Tiger Kerr and Fingers Inch.
Oh, but I know Fingers.
Okay, well, I name-dropped you.
Into the break button.
I mentioned a couple of the things you said about fighting the F8 and the F4, so we're going to have a little fun with that. We might have to bring you back after that airs on Monday, July 22nd. Otherwise, Sunshine.
What do we always say, Jello?
Let's get out of here.
All right.
All right.
See ya.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.